So just want to thank everyone for your prayers and your cards that you've sent us in the past week as we've mourned the loss of Evie's grandmother. So we traveled down to Virginia, spent time with family, and just remembered her. And she was such a strong woman of faith. I mean, just remarkably strong. And it was so pivotal to my life just later on as I got to know Evie and her family. And this is a woman who loved kids and only had one kid and had wanted so many more and could only have the one. And so she adopted all the kids in her youth group and the Sunday school class that she taught and raised a ton of other kids. And then through her son had three kids and now had, you know, eight great-grandkids. And all of them focused on the Lord. And so she knew what was important. She was very poor most of her life, but she found joy in just the Lord in a way that I haven't seen many people do. And she knew what was important. And it was no more apparent than at the funeral when we got to celebrate her and talk about her being with Jesus, the one person that she wanted to be with. And so it was good. And we thank you guys for your prayers. We thank you for all the things that you've kind notes and cards and flowers that you've sent us. It's been amazing. So we start a series today, an Advent series, in Isaiah. And Isaiah is a complicated person in the Old Testament. Isaiah lived at one time, and he prophesied or he shared things that were going to happen in Israel over a span of over 100 years. And so sometimes Isaiah is talking to the people that are contemporary to him. Sometimes he's talking to people far in the future. Sometimes he's talking to people who are far in the future and are no longer in the kingdom of which he's a part now. And it's a complicated, very complicated book. But it's a good book because it gives us a picture through different eyes of what we can expect from Jesus. It's Advent now, and it seems like it was just the summer a couple weeks ago. Time has just flown by. And the way our culture operates during this time is we skip through all the in-between times. We go straight from summer to Halloween to Thanksgiving to Christmas. And all the in-between times are just kind of pushed through. They're seen as the times to prepare for the gifts of Christmas morning, the Santa Claus and the gifts and the gatherings. But Advent for Christians can be really good if we take our time. It can be really good because it prepares our hearts not for Santa Claus and family gatherings and gift giving, which are all great things. It prepares our heart for what Christ's coming into this world means for our lives. I mean, we know what Christ's coming into the world means. It's not a surprise. We know it. But this time of year gives us the chance, the ability to reflect on that, to press into that, and to see what it means for us in the world. So that's hopefully what we will look at through this Advent season, through the eyes of Isaiah, because Isaiah saw things differently, as pretty much all the prophets did, but Isaiah especially. So let's pray, and we'll get started. Lord, guide our hearts and our minds. Shape us to look to you. Open us to your word, to your desire in our lives, that we might glorify you always and forever. Amen. How many of you guys had favorite stories growing up? Like favorite storybooks or things you like to read, or maybe even favorite shows on television that you would watch over and over again and that you couldn't get enough of? That you could sit all day long and listen to the stories or watch the stories or read the stories. I did. I had a ton of things that I really liked, but the stories that I liked the most were the stories of Camelot, Not JFK's Camelot, but King Arthur's Camelot. The story of this orphan, depending on which story you read, the story of this orphan boy who had nothing to offer the world, was weak, was not even a knight, was not even a powerful figure, who through just happenstance is able to pull a sword, Excalibur, from a stone, and through his wits and bravery rule a nation. And the thing about King Arthur's Camelot that I really especially liked was that he ruled righteously. He looked after those who were poor and downtrodden. He tried to uphold the good of the land. And apart from the stories of knights that would go off to battle giants and evil, there was a desire to see justice done in the world of King Arthur's Camelot. But the stories were just fairy tales. They were made up. And even in the world of the fairy tales, even in the world of the made up stories, corruption enters in. The kingdom, the righteous kingdom, doesn't last. King Arthur is betrayed by his most trusted friend, Lancelot. King Arthur's knights of the Round Table abandon him, and he's killed in a battle trying to defend the kingdom. Corruption entered in. We like those stories because, apart from the ending of King Arthur, we know that in the world, those kinds of things don't happen. We look for righteousness. We look for peace. We want things to be right. We want justice. We want peace. We can look around and we can see the problems. We can look around and see where things are wrong, and we want things to be right. Whether you're a Christian or not, you know that things are not right, that there are things that are wrong in the world, that things could be better, that something in this world is not right. You can see it in the headlines. You can sense it deep down. You know that there's a better way. Now, you may disagree over what will fix those things, but we can at least agree that things need fixing. And there are all kinds of thoughts about what will fix things. One political party over the other. More laws, less laws, greater economic equity, greater all kinds of policies that will make things better. One of my friends who's an old, retired, crusty Marine, he calls his solution the herbal remedy, and he swears that if everybody just sat down and, you know, smoked a little bit of weed together, everything would be better. But people have ideas about what makes the world better, no matter how crazy it is. But none of those solutions are the solutions of Isaiah's vision that we read this morning. The solution of Isaiah's vision is very simple. It's really almost too simple. Complete and utter reliance upon God. Reliance upon His word and His law as guides. Submission to God. That all the nations, all the people will look to God for their answers and their guidance. That's Isaiah's solution. And the picture that Isaiah paints is unbelievable. It doesn't seem possible. Not when we look at the world around us, it seems impossible. There's a picture of justice and peace reigning supreme, a picture of this righteous ruler, God, leading all the nations to peace. And it's a really beautiful picture, really. But it just doesn't make much sense in the light of what we experience on a daily basis. Because on a daily basis, we really don't see this kind of thing happening. We don't see the nations looking to God. We don't see people looking to God to guide their every step. We don't see complete and utter reliance upon God. The song we sang earlier, I Heard the Christmas Bells, was written by the poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. as he struggled with this very thing. On July 9th of 1861, he was taking a nap. And his wife was doing work around the house, his wife of 18 years. And for whatever reason or whatever she was doing, her dress caught on fire. And she burned. And he woke up from his nap and he put the fire out. But it was too late. She died the very next day from her wounds, from the burns. He was burnt so bad that he wasn't able to go to her funeral. And for years afterwards, he grew out a beard to hide the scars on his neck and his face. And then barely 2 years later, when his son turned 18, his youngest son left without telling the family to join the Union Army to fight in the Civil War. And he found out about it through a telegram. And a few months later, he received another telegram saying that his son had been critically wounded in a battle. And he rushed to Washington, D.C. to be with his son. And he got there, and one doctor said that he would never walk again, that he was paralyzed because a bullet had grazed his spine. And then other doctors said things were going to be okay. But as he sat by his son's hospital bed on Christmas morning of 1863, he looked around at the pain and suffering in the world, and he struggled to understand. Because the cries and the singing of peace on earth and goodwill toward men, it didn't fit what he experienced. As he looked around, he saw warfare and pain and sorrow and suffering. He didn't understand how there could be peace. Isaiah was an active prophet during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And if you lived during this time period, if you lived in the kingdom of Judea, things weren't right. Things were pretty bad. There were periods of favor, but overall things were bad because Assyria was a dominant force in the world. Assyria was the superpower of the world at that time. And to feed the ever-growing kingdom of Assyria, it had to invade. And the one place that Assyria looked to invade was Egypt. And if you know the geology or the geography of the Middle East, you know that Assyria was northeast. And Egypt was down here. And in between Assyria and Egypt was the land of Judea and Israel and many other countries. And for Assyria to get to Egypt, it had to go through all these little countries that were in its way. And it couldn't leave them behind, because if it left these countries behind, then they could attack their supply lines. So Assyria had to go to Egypt through all these other little countries. And so there was the risk and the fear of war all around. The fear and risk of invasion constantly. Even in times of peace, there was always the fear that Assyria would come in and decimate the land. And if you're this little tiny country of Judea, then you found yourself in a difficult situation. And for many years, Assyria was the pressure, and it dominated. So much so that the kings of Judah either sought alliances with other countries around them or would seek to align themselves with Assyria. And the temptation was always to look to other solutions, other things, other than God. Even good kings during this time looked to other solutions. They were blinded by all the things around them, the pressure of invasion. And it was a power and dominance game. The country that could dominate held all of the power, Assyria. And incidentally, in the thinking of the people of that time, the country that held the most power, the most dominance, were seen to have the most powerful gods. That is why time after time we see the kings of Israel and the kings of Judea turn to other gods. That's how other gods began to creep into the country. We see it in 2 Kings 16, when Ahaz, one of the kings during Isaiah's prophesying, seeks the Syrian king for peace and help, and bows as a vassal to this king. And it shapes the worship in Jerusalem. 2 Kings 16 tells us that Ahaz sent a letter, a diagram back to the priest to change the way they worshiped to please the king of Assyria. But Isaiah isn't fooled. He isn't blinded by the way in which every other country sees the world. He isn't fooled by the war and the pressure and the threat of war around them. He sees God for who God is. He sees God as the God, the ruler, and the creator of the universe, who chose to make his dwelling place not among the most powerful of nations, but among the small nation. You see, the God of Jacob is the God who reigns supreme. And it is into this situation that Isaiah prophesies. He reminds the Jewish people that the gods of other nations are not gods, that they pale in comparison to the God of Jacob. He says in verse 2 that the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. The place where the God of Jacob dwells will be the most prominent. And if you know the kings of this time period, the gods of this time period, they were all thought to dwell in mountains. So the Assyrian king Baal lived in a mountain, and the Greek kings the Greek gods and the Egyptian gods all ruled from mountains. And Isaiah is saying that the most prominent of mountains will be the one found in Jerusalem. That God, the God of Jacob, that he is the most accurate reflection of reality. That there is one God, the creator of all things, and he has made his home among the Jews of Judea. And by virtue of this decision, the mountain upon which this temple rests is the highest. See, God has no need to compete with the other gods of the world, because the other gods of the world are fictitious. They aren't real. And it is from this mountain that the law goes forth. It is from this mountain that the word of the Lord will go out to teach people how they must live. It is from this place that humanity will be taught and led. And it's a beautiful picture in Isaiah. Now, we often see the law as a pain, that it seems to be outdated and no longer any good. But it is a picture of human flourishing, complete and utter reliance upon God. Is it a picture that you have made true in your life? Do you come to Him to learn His ways? Do you long for His word to guide you, to feed you, to sustain you? You see, all other ways are fake. They're fictitious. All other gods that we pursue are not real gods. Over and over, Isaiah proclaims that. The one true God, the God of Jacob, is the only God. Do you delight in His law as a guide for your life? Is your trust as radical as the picture painted in verse 4? The nations put all of their trust in the Lord, so much so that they turn their weapons of war into tools for agriculture. This isn't just a simple repurposing. They literally transform their weapons, the weapons that they would use to protect them, in this picture, this vision that Isaiah gives, these weapons that they would use to protect them against all the forces outside, they have such complete trust in the Lord that they turn these weapons into tools. that they can say, no, we no longer going to lean on ourselves, our own understanding, our own ways of figuring things out. Those ways we give up. And we are going to pursue you, God, and we are going to trust in you. And so we will turn these things into tools for production. Is your trust that radical? Do you have that complete and utter reliance upon God? So much so that there's no way back. I want my faith to look like that. I want my faith to be that strong and that deep. And sadly, most days it's not. I think the biblical picture of many of the people in the Bible, it's not that strong. But it's something that we should long for. It's something that we should pray for, that we should reach for and grasp for. Do we? I think of the call of the disciples when Jesus called them. They left things behind. They gave up things that gave them security to follow him. They burned their bridges. They never looked back to walk fully, completely, reliantly upon the Lord. I remember years ago being deeply impacted by a story of an inner city pastor. I don't remember who it was. It was in a book I read, and I don't even remember the book, or I would have read the quote. But he was an inner city pastor, and he lived a few blocks away from the church, and one night he was walking to the church with his wife, and as they approached the church building, somebody came up to him and pulled out a pistol and told him that he wanted their money. And the pastor only had a couple dollars in his pocket, and he looked at the guy and he said, hey, I don't have anything but a couple of dollars, but I have a couple of dollars in the church that you're more than welcome to have when we get there, and I'll make sure that I feed you too, and you'll be well fed. And I remember reading that story thinking how hard that was to process. Because in my mind, I'm thinking like, okay, what's the defensive tactics to take out the gun and the guy? And this guy, his immediate thought was, other than being afraid, was how can I help this man? His trust was so much in the Lord that instead of just giving the $2 and hoping the guy went away, he invited him to the church to give him more money and to feed him. And if I remember the story correctly, that man went on to become a follower of Jesus and have an impact in the city in a way that pastor never had. That's the kind of faith that I want. I think of missionaries who leave everything behind to go to serve in places of danger, that have such a passion to serve the Lord that they don't care what they leave behind. They just leave it all behind to go serve him. And I want that. Makes me wonder what I would or should give up. Because we are invited to live this kind of faith. We are invited to come to the Lord in this way. We don't have to wait for some far-off time, this time in the future. This can be reality in our own life. You see, because Isaiah's vision, all nations are invited to this. It begins in the last days. Look at verse 2. Those days are now. And we've talked about this in the past. Whenever we see any kind of allusion to the last days in the Old Testament, the early church, the first century church, took that to mean the time when Jesus would be here. The time that the Messiah would come, the incarnation. And so in the last days is when Jesus comes, when the Messiah appears. Hebrews 1:1-2 says this, in the past God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son, whom appointed heir of all things, and through whom also he made the universe. That is what Advent is about. It is about anticipation and celebration of the one who is coming and who invites us and makes it possible for us to worship. It is anticipation of a just and righteous ruler. God has spoken to us by his Son. His law has gone out from Zion. His word has gone out from Jerusalem to all nations through his Son. The ancient Near Eastern gods were marked by dominance and power. It was in dominance that the world saw their power through the countries that they were the gods of. But God comes, the true God comes to this world as a baby. He sheds the power and the glory of heaven to put on the flesh of man. As John 1:14 says, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who comes from the Father, full of grace and truth. If you think about what Jesus did, he beat his sword and his spear into a plowshare, to a pruning hook. Jesus, the one who could command legions of armies, who did not have to be lifted up to the cross, who could have fought that with violence and judgment, who had every right, forswore those things so that we could follow him. He had the power to employ anything to keep himself from the cross. But paradoxically, it's through his willingness to go to the cross that we had the possibility, the slightest possibility of peace in our lives. It is through Jesus that we come before God. It is through Jesus that we have possibility of peace. Longfellow looked out on a country that had begun with the promise of peace, but was ripped apart by the Civil War. And as he looked out, he heard church bells ringing, ringing out the truth of reality that even in the midst of turmoil and strife, during times when no one could point to hope, God's kingdom is here. It isn't romantic or fictional, it is real. The rule of the righteous king is real, and his rule is eternal. His rule never fails, never ends, and is always right. In his words, he says, "And in despair I bowed my head. There is no peace on earth, I said, for hate is strong and mocks the song of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Then pealed the bells more loud and deep. God is not dead, nor doth he sleep. The wrong shall fail, the right prevail, with peace on earth, goodwill to men." Because he is a judge, wrong shall fail, and right prevail ultimately. As we look around and see all that is wrong, all the things that need fixed, we can be sure that he is at work, even now, to make those things right. And we are invited to come to him. Come, let us walk in the light. Let's pray. Lord, guide us, please. Guide us to be people who follow you, who long for you, who long for your law, for your direction, your guidance in our lives, Lord, who lay things down that stand in the way of following you, who leave those things behind and cling only to you. Help us during this Advent season to be people who do that. Reveal to us the things in our lives that stand in the way of following you, and help us to release them. Jesus, I thank you for all that you are, all that you have done, and all that you continue to do, even when we don't see it. In your name I pray. Amen.